Good afternoon and welcome to the June 27th, 2016 special conference call hosted by the Harbour Group of RBC Dominion Securities, where we'll be focusing on the British exit from the European Union, commonly referred to as Brexit, in today's conference call. My name is Chris Newell. I'm one of the partners with the Harbour Group, and I'm joined by our lead strategist, Robin Gullison. And as we've done with other calls, we'll be doing this in a question and answer format, touching on the questions that have been most common from clients in the recent days. The first question to Robin is, what happened? Can you please give us an overview of the situation regarding Brexit?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. I won't go into too much detail. This has all been dominating the news over the last weekend, but essentially when Prime Minister Cameron got elected to government last year, he promised to have a referendum on the UK's membership in the European Union, and that referendum happened on June 23rd on Thursday. Going into the vote, the polls were showing that the Remain in the EU camp was leading by a couple percentage points, and the history of the past few referendums has been that typically the status quo goes on to do a few points better at the actual vote than it does in the polls. Therefore, most people, including the odds makers who had markets become a lot more reliant on, because the odds makers in England have actually predicted the last couple of elections in the Scottish referendum better than the polls. Those are showing an overwhelming indication that they were going to remain in the EU. And markets got a bit ahead of themselves and essentially had priced in a Remain victory ahead of the vote, actually on the day of the vote. And of course, we all know what happened. The Leave side won 52-48. We've seen a sharp repricing in markets since. As of now, the S&P 500 is down about 5% from levels that prevailed before that. But again, at that point, the S&P 500 was basically at its highs for the year, so that's worth noting. You did have a big run-up going into it, so even though we're off a fair bit, it was off a pretty high level. The TSX is down about 3%. The Canadian dollar is about 2.5% weaker, and bond yields have fallen around the world for a high-quality government bond. Now, going forward, we would note that this is just one component of the EU's decision to leave the European Union. In the months and years to come, there will be a lot of discussion over how the UK and its relationship with the EU will be structured. There's still a lot of uncertainties and a lot of implications to make going forward, but it's going to be a long time before we know what's actually going to happen. We'd also note that this referendum is advisory, not mandatory, meaning that what happens next is more a question of politics than law. If the government invokes what they call Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, that's when things get a little more real. At that point, the Brexit would become a matter of law, and it starts a clock ticking for 2 years of negotiations before the UK would actually exit the European Union. And to extend that timeline, you'd need a unanimous vote from all the other members, which seems a little bit unlikely, given the rhetoric we've seen from a lot of the Europeans over the past couple of days. It's been a bit mixed, but a lot of the European governments have come out and said, well, if you're going to leave, then get on with it. Let's invoke Article 15, get the negotiations underway. But maybe not that surprising that people like the former London Mayor Boris Johnson, who's one of the main speakers for the Leave side, is saying, well, not so fast. We don't have to invoke Article 50 right away. Let's take our time. So it could be that this just ends up being some sort of negotiating tactic. There's a long and rich history of European governments holding multiple referenda until they get the result they want. So this could be something that just leads to more negotiations between the Europeans and the Brits. But I guess the overarching story is that we don't know what's going to happen yet. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. And until they invoke this Article 50, it's all really just conjecture, because until that's invoked, they remain members of the European Union.
Robin, thanks for that overview. So the first question that I would have for you is this Brexit going to create some sort of a domino effect? And should we here on this side of the ocean be overly concerned?
That's definitely the bigger concern. If you look at how large the UK economy is within the world, how much trade the UK has with Canada or the US, that's kind of a minor point as far as the markets are concerned. What the markets are much more concerned about is a contagion of some sort. So this exactly leading to a domino effect whereby other European countries, particularly countries that use the euro, start to leave the European Union. And to monitor that, we look at things like the sovereign bond yields in countries like Spain and Italy and Portugal. And this kind of might sound, taking you back in time to 2011 and 2012, and that's what all the markets were watching. And we're kind of back to watching those now. I'd say there's been one encouraging development on that front. Spain had an election just on Sunday, and people thought that the electorate was going to go more with the Eurosceptic parties or the non-consensus parties, but the main party that was in control there actually won more, a larger percentage of the vote than people had thought. So there's a bit of a tempering of that fear that it was going to go all towards the insurgent parties. But what we're looking at is, again, the behavior of these sovereign bond markets, and that'll be an indication of what happens next. Right now, it's a little bit too early to say, but again, I'd say that it's a lot easier for the UK to lead than a core euro country because the UK has its own central bank, they have their own currency, etc. For a core euro country to leave, it's a lot bigger deal because, again, they'd have to print their own currency, get their own central bank going again, redenominate all their contracts and their bonds and its new currency. A much bigger deal, and I would note that despite all the pain and drama that's happened in Greece over the last few years, they still decide to remain a member of the European Union, whereas conventional economics would suggest that maybe it'd be easier for them to leave because they could go to their own currency, devalue it, and have an export-led growth. They haven't gone that way. So obviously, I think a lot of the people in Europe still place a lot of value in being in this common market and using the currency.
Robin, to layer on to that question with regards to the domino effect, it's often said that so goes the economy, so goes corporate profitability, ultimately so go markets. Outside of politics, how are economies doing? Is the U.S. economy still growing? Is the Canadian economy still growing? What's happening in the European economy?
So it's been, you know, much of the same we've seen for the last few years, slow but positive growth. And while that's not all that exciting, it's actually proven to be pretty positive for markets because slow but positive growth leads to low inflation, leads to low interest rates, and leads to loose monetary policy. What we worry about more, kind of paradoxically, is overheating economic growth, which leads to high inflation and leads central banks to raise interest rates significantly, and that tends to be what leads to a recession. So the growth outlook in the UK is obviously going to decrease because of this, even if they don't exit. Just the amount of uncertainty for their economy there, I think, is going to slow down consumer spending. For example, are people going to go buy a new house, or are they going to, you know, take on large purchases when they're worried about what this is going to mean for jobs and things like that. The second order effect would be on the European Union to a much smaller degree than the UK. And then for countries outside of the European Union and the UK, such as Canada and the US, we would expect the fallout to be fairly minimal on a direct economic basis. The bigger risk would be on the financial market side if you had financial conditions tighten because of this, meaning that, you know, if credit spreads were to go up for corporate bonds or there's to be prolonged significant volatility in the stock market, that might have a little bit more of an effect. But as far as what's happening in the UK, we don't expect that to affect the Canadian economy all that much. The Canadian economy is getting much more affected by what's happening with the oil price, the reconstruction from the fires in Fort McMurray, that sort of thing. So we don't think this is going to have a direct impact on the Canadian economy that'll be really measurable.
Thank you. And so making this more specific for our listeners' individual portfolios, you know, one of the questions that we've been asked is, if a client is sitting at their target asset allocation, and just as a side note, asset allocation is the mix between stocks, bonds, and cash in a client's portfolio, should this news about Brexit cause someone to make a radical asset allocation shift, either adding substantially more risk on or taking a whole lot of risk off the table?
In short, the answer would be no. So as we discussed earlier, this seems like it's going to be a long, drawn-out process, and the outcome is unclear. We certainly expect an increase in volatility, which we have definitely seen the last few days, as investors sort out what the world's going to look like, what the implications are for global and European growth. But we don't think a referendum result should be something that causes people to have a market shift in their asset allocation, particularly considering a lot of thought has gone into this asset allocation and personalizing it for each investor's risk tolerance and goals and objectives. If markets correct to levels that reveal compelling valuations in either equities or corporate bonds where we think we can substantially add value to portfolios in the future or increase safe income, then it might actually prove appropriate to raise the allocation to sectors such as equities and corporate bonds, but that'll be valuation dependent.
Terrific. So Robin, could you let us know what our respective research sources are saying? So outside of our own primary research in our office, could you let our listeners know what the RBC Global Asset Management view is and some of the other providers that we subscribe to, just to ensure that they understand that we have an unbiased perspective?
Absolutely. So we have three major resources we look at for outside research out of our own office. Number one would be the various parts of RBC, which would include RBC Global Asset Management, RBC Capital Markets, RBC's Portfolio Advisory Group. would also include JP Morgan, whose research RBC subscribes to on a wide basis. And JP Morgan, as I'm sure you're aware, is a large global investment bank with offices and research capabilities around the world in all different asset classes. And we also subscribe to a company called the Bank Credit Analyst out of Montreal, who provides a really good overview of economic analysis and stock market asset allocation that we subscribe to here at the Harbor Group. So to break down what these three different outside research sources are saying, RBC Asset Management's view is that they don't think it's going to morph into a Lehman Brothers-like contagion marked by opaque markets and cascading losses. RBC is not rushing to buy the dip here. They think there's going to be more volatility to be seen, but they're not looking for this to cause a U.S. recession. I think that's pretty important. JP Morgan is also the opinion that we're going to see more volatility, but it's likely to be much more regionally centered in the U.K. and the EU. They think this is going to last a few weeks. Their equity strategist thinks we could see another 5 to 7% downside in the S&P 500, but they're maintaining their target of 2,000 on the S&P 500 for year-end 2016. I'll note that's the same level we're at now, but they are also the lowest level on the street for S&P 500 targets. To give you a bit of perspective, RBC Capital Markets forecast is 2,225, about 10% higher than where we are now. Lastly, Bank Credit Analyst, I'll preface with saying they've been, I'd say, relatively bearish on equities. They don't think we're in a bear market, but they're a little more cautious. So their view is that this has created challenges for the global economy and financial markets, and it's kind of hard to disagree with that in the short term. They think investors should take a more defensive stance, but again, they're not calling for a bear market in stocks. I'd like to point out, though, these people at Bank Credit Analysts look at stock markets around the world and look at them in broad index views, and I think if we were to look at how our portfolios are constructed, it would already be a relatively defensive stance compared to what the index looks like in Canada. So I think as far as going more defensive, we're not as defensive as we could possibly be, I'd say, but our base case portfolios are much more defensive than the index here in Canada, so I think that's worth saying. But the bottom line is none of the research sources we follow are calling for a bear market or a U.S. recession, and those are the kind of big things we look out for if we're going to have a large-scale change in asset allocation, and that doesn't appear to be the case right now.
Thanks, Robin. A handful of clients over the last several days have asked about gold, and should gold play a meaningful role in the portfolio? And I guess that dialogue and narrative has taken the center stage given the flare-up of Brexit. Could you speak to that, Robin, for a moment?
Yeah, absolutely. The volatility in equity markets in the past few days has certainly highlighted the role that gold can play during times of economic uncertainty. But if you look at the long term, you have these big rallies in gold when things are going a bit haywire, then as often as not, it tends to give a lot of that back in the aftermath of these flare-ups and volatility. So our experience investing in the gold sector has been that company-specific issues often overwhelm the underlying price of gold. Never say never, we don't envision gold being a core part of portfolios in the long term. And the other reason for that would be that it's very hard to get cash flow out of a gold-type investment. If you're going to allocate 10% of your portfolio to gold, and to get any sort of meaningful hedge out of it, you'd have to allocate a fair bit. 1%, 2% is not going to do it. So if you allocate 10% of your portfolio to gold, it generates no yield, and over the long term, it kind of oscillates up and down, but in real terms, doesn't make a lot of progress to the upside. That means the rest of your portfolio has to work that much harder to deliver compounded returns and deliver that cash flow. So in essence, you'd have to increase the risk in the rest of your portfolio to compensate for the long-term returns you're unlikely to get from the gold sector. So to us, it seems like long-term you'd be increasing your risk for an uncertain return characteristic.
That reminds me of the old Warren Buffett adage, no matter how hard you rub gold, it'll never generate a dividend. The next question is, how long are we going to expect this volatility to last? It seems like every summer it's something. It's Greece 1 year, it's Italy another year, it's Spain another year, and here the dog days of summer have set in. Volatility is back. Is this a summer event, or how long will this last, Robin?
Well, historically, the summer months have been definitely a little more challenging. If you look at the average returns, the summer and early fall months tend to be the lower returning months. That said, if you look at any given year, the chance of one of these more challenging months being up or down is not much better than a coin flip. So over a very long period of time, these summer and fall months are more challenging, but in any given year, you can be surprised what the returns look like. But yes, absolutely, it seems to be in the summertime we get these flare-ups, and the lack of liquidity in the summer definitely doesn't help with a lot more people go on vacation, particularly the Europeans who tend to go on very long summer vacations. So you know, I wouldn't be surprised if this lasts into the fall. This is an unexpected event. Markets were not priced for it at all. They went completely the wrong way ahead of the results. You have to think there's some leverage positions that are being unwound here, and that's leading to the volatility. After this, of course, you have the U.S. election coming up, and people are going to fret about that until they get a clear view on what the outcome is going to be. So, yes, you know, I think this volatility could last through the summer and into the fall. That wouldn't be unusual, but I think the more important thing to think about is volatility. It's how we react to volatility and what, how we set the portfolios with the opportunities that present themselves that determine our longer-term returns. So, as you discussed in a lot of our notes and conference calls, in the short term, the market is volatile. It always is. It's always something. But that's the price you have to pay to generate longer-term strong returns.
Does Brexit have any impact on our outlook for oil?
In the short term, it's going to have an impact because oil has kind of been turned into a financial commodity. So in the last 10 years, a lot more financial money has gone into the oil business and into the oil market. And from a physical basis, we looked at RBC Capital Markets notes, and they actually are forecasting $55.50 a barrel WTI for the second half of 2016. We put out a note over the weekend, and they don't think the Brexit changes the fundamental view at all, but they are saying that, of course, in the short term, the financial markets are going to create more volatility towards oil. We would agree with that, but in our view, the fundamentals haven't really changed all that much, and that's what's going to win out in the long term.
We've got three more questions. So one of the last ones is, what does this mean for interest rates? Leading up to today's call and the last conference calls that we've had, Robin, you've articulated that the Federal Reserve was going to start raising interest rates and ultimately Canada would follow suit at some point in time. Does this Brexit announcement derail that thought process?
In short, yes, it does. This is going to be interest rates lower for even longer, and we sound like a broken record here, and it seems like every time they get close to the precipice of raising interest rates, something happens. And as you mentioned before, Chris, every summer it seems like there's something. And I think what's happened with the Federal Reserve's reaction function, as they call it, is that these global events have started to make their way into how the Federal Reserve acts. And I think 20 years ago, it was much more about what was happening in the domestic economy. And if you look purely at the U.S. domestic economy, I think you could argue that interest rates should be higher. We're starting to see wage growth. We've got a very low unemployment rate, and under any normal scenario, you'd see interest rates in the U.S. higher. But the Fed has taken a very special concern to things that are going on around the world, be it happening in China, in Europe, and that's going to slow them down. And by definition, that should slow down the Bank of Canada. So interest rates lower for longer, that, I think, helps our portfolios at the margin because we do have a, you know, dividend-heavy portfolios, and this is going to help any and all income-producing assets because you're now at a point where, you know, almost half of government bonds around the world trade with a negative yield, and even a third of European corporate bonds now trade with a negative yield. So I think as this continues, investors are going to grab for cash flow wherever they can find it, and they're going to have to take more risk to do so.
Really just staggering to think that you've got to extend term to almost a decade in parts of Europe to get a positive yield on a government bond. The next and second last question, Robin, is related to currency. So we saw a very rapid adjustment with the British pound over the course of the Brexit vote and again today, and that had some implications on the Canadian dollar. Can you give us an idea of what the RBC outlook is for the British pound relative to the Canadian dollar? And then should this guide any of our thinking on portfolios, Canadian dollars, U.S. dollars, and such?
Well, the outlook for the British pound, from what I've read, is continues to be negative. So you've had a huge reaction to the British pound so far, but the consensus seems to be that there's further to go there. You know, as much as another 5 to 10 cents versus the U.S. dollar, less than that versus the Canadian dollar, because the Canadian dollar is also weakening as the U.S. dollar broadly has been strengthening. So for unhedged British pound exposures, we would expect a little more negative performance there. Not that I think a lot of people have that exposure in their portfolios, but yes, so the British pound has been very volatile. I would not expect that to change anytime soon, particularly as this becomes more of a political than economic situation. If you remember, again, the summers of 2011, 2012, when the politicians get involved, you know, it's hard enough to forecast the economy and what's going on. Forecasting what politicians are going to do is, I think, 10 times harder. So I expect British pound volatility to be very high. As it goes to the Canadian dollar, I think, again, it seems like the U.S. dollar strength is going to hold the day for a while here. If you look at what's happening with the central banks, the central bank in the U.S. is now on hold, and the view is that the Canadian central bank probably hikes 6 months after the U.S. central bank. So In the near term, I think it becomes more about what happens with the oil price for the Canadian dollar. And as the central banks seem like they're going to both be on hold for a very long period of time. But as long as there's stress in the market here, that tends to benefit the U.S. dollar. So I would expect the Canadian dollar to weaken a bit more in the near term as the U.S. dollar continues to gain its flight to safety bid.
Terrific. So I guess the last question that I'd end off with here is this a buying opportunity? You know, how should we be thinking about this in terms of taking advantage of the summer volatility?
I think the bottom line is this a buying opportunity or not? The view has to be, are we going to see a U.S. recession or not? That's been the linchpin of our strategy, and everything we've seen here is that we're not going to have a U.S. recession in the near term. This doesn't change that outlook at all. And in the fullness of time, we think there will be a buying opportunity here as volatility has tended to present that all the way throughout the cycle. Doesn't mean it's going to be today or tomorrow, but we think that the businesses that we look out for, you know, if they go to a level we think is attractive, we think it'll be a buying opportunity. And that's how we're viewing it now. We don't think this is a call to sell everything. If you remember a few months ago, one of the British banks, ironically enough, put out a call to sell everything, and that was actually right near the lows in February. And we think as this goes on, it will continue to be a buying opportunity because, again, this isn't something that should be causing a long-term global economic contagion. We think Canada is looking like it's a good place to invest. If you look at what's happening around the world, you have all the troubles in Europe with the migrant crisis, and now, of course, a bit of a crisis with the Brexit. The UK, obviously, I wouldn't say uninvestable, but definitely going to be very volatile for a long time. In the U.S., you're going to have more focus on the U.S. election, and unless it turns out very quickly that Hillary Clinton is going to win this thing, you'll see people starting to worry about Trump. Look at Canada. Canada is almost an island of tranquility in comparison. Obviously, you have the commodity sector that kind of moves around the Canadian market quite a bit from a political standpoint, so it's probably a pretty attractive place to invest for a lot of investors. And if you do see continued momentum to the upside in oil, the foreigners may just come back, and this political stability is another feather in Canada's cap.
Terrific. Well, Robin, thanks very much for your time, and to our listeners and clients who have dialed into this, thank you very much for dialing in, and we encourage your communication. If there was a question that you have that wasn't answered in today's call, or you'd just like to follow up and discuss it further, please do feel free to give us a call. And with that, we wish you a good day. We will be having another conference call in the month of July, and we'll be carrying on with topics that are salient at that point in time. Have a good day.